Hello and welcome everyone to mineral testing. And we're going to talk about all the different places where you could test minerals in the body. Hair, urine, feces, blood, and then some esoteric tests and functional tests as well. And come up with, for you, a plan of how you're going to assess people. I, from the start, will say that I don't do a lot of lab testing for minerals until I've started out by looking at some of the functional and the history and the exam, and actually looked at updating their diet and really upregulating the minerals. Because if you have somebody coming in off the street, face it, they're most likely mineral deficient. So if you're going to be trying to test their minerals in their blood or their urine or their stool or their hair, you're going to find deficiencies. So why not get their diet cleaned up first? Different if you've got somebody who comes in and says, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, I'm doing everything under the sun. If this seems to be an issue, the thing you'll do, I do more than I do the essential minerals, I rarely do those, is the toxics, because it's really important to get the toxic metals out of a person. We've got our disclaimer that this is not medical advice. You will not be dispensing medical advice. You will be giving people education and tools that they can use and share and work with their doctor in if they have a problem. And the same thing with you, as you're taking this information in and you're thinking about it for yourself, you make sure that you're making informed decisions. The ones at the top, mineral background information, those are definitely ones that you'll want to reference, if you, especially if you don't have a book. And I'm going to give you some links to some of my favorite books, because it's really a good idea to have a book that you can reference that goes into lots of detail. And I have lists of those ones that I like that really go into detail, and I'll tell you what the differences are between them. And the more you learn, the more you do, the more you accumulate reference materials, not books that you're necessarily going to read cover to cover, but books that you're going to refer to when you're dealing with somebody and you're suspicious of some mineral imbalances. You want to look it up and look up what are some of the more esoteric signs, or what are some of the foods that replenish those, etc. Although I will caution you that most of the books that are out there, the standard nutrition books, they talk about foods that we may not think are in the best interest of the person in terms of where they can find the nutrients. Like, you know, call it calcium, go get some milk and you'll have calcium. So we need to temper those with our own. So the ones at the top, deficiency signs and predisposing factors, this I put together for you. Actually, I just put it together for you from our mineral deficiency chart, the form, part of the scorecards. So I just kind of turned it into more of a list, a checklist for you, so that calcium, you know, do they have any of these symptoms? Chromium, copper, iodine, iron, magnesium, manganese, phosphorus, potassium, and zinc. So there's one for all the major minerals anyway. Not all of the esoteric minerals are in there, but we'll talk about molybdenum and some of the other charts. So that's one. And then the next one, I actually made you copies of some of my forms from a couple of the books that I like a lot. And they're just the best I could do on a scanner with a book that has a thing, but you get the idea. And once you get books like this of your own, you'll be able to refer. This one is taken from a book, a nutrition and physiology book, because I found it, and I found it as a really good deal if you got the previous level. I got edition 4 versus edition 6 or whatever the latest one was for like $20-$30 versus $180, because textbooks are expensive. If you've been to college, you know that textbooks are really expensive, and this is a nice textbook, and it just gives you a lot of the background, the biochemistry of all the nutrients, so it's a good one to have. I just copied out the couple of the charts, the macro minerals, and the first way, of course, you're going to test for deficiencies is by looking at that, the stuff. So the mineral testing primer. This is something that I found online, and it looked like it had some pretty good stuff in it. I haven't read it cover to cover, but it looked like some good overviews of the various types of testing and mineral testing in the hair, mostly, is what they were going through. So you get a background on that, and then Minerals and Immunity is a nice little paper that talks about the importance of minerals in the immune system. So those are some background pages. The next group are some testing documents from the various lab tests that actually do the mineral testing. Doctor's Data, Metametrics, Great Plains, Genova Diagnostics. And what I've included is some of the instruction sheets and the test descriptions. and interpretation guide. So that's what's in this set. These are things that you could find online, but quite frankly, it took me quite a bit of time to locate them all and download them all. So now you have them all in one place. And sample reports. I took sample reports from the various tests that we're going to be going through today, and I put them here. And once we've gone through the discussion with the slides, which talk about the various tests and which is the more ideal place to test each mineral, then we can go through and look at some of the samples. And a great way to learn is using those samples because they usually have some really nice descriptions. It's really important that you get to know your minerals, that you understand. We all kind of know what calcium does and kind of know what magnesium does and zinc, but it's really good to get into it in just a little bit more detail. You don't have to memorize long charts and, you know, every single symptom, but it's nice to have a reference guide where you're suspicious. Oh, zinc, do they have any other signs of zinc deficiency? And you can look it up. Healing Power of Minerals, Special Nutrients and Trace Elements by Paul Bergner. It's a nice little paperback, and it's got a few pages on each of the minerals, and then some general stuff about minerals in general and nutrients in general. Nice little book, and it tells you, you know, sources and herbal sources, etc. Mental and Elemental Nutrients is huge. It's very big. It talks a lot about it related to mental health, the minerals related to mental health, but it also has really good chapters on each of the nutrients, and you can see how they relate to conditions that are related to mental health, because a lot of minerals do have a relationship with your brain. And then finally, this is more of a classic textbook, but it has a lot of good information about the minerals in addition to a lot of good charts, and you get to see it from the perspective of, you know, classic nutrition training, advanced nutrition and human metabolism. The minerals are in chapters 11 to 13. And like I said, the third edition, I gave you a link to it, the fourth edition, sorry, is available at a fraction of the price of the big one, and that's the edition that I have. The chapters might be slightly different in the new edition, if you get that. But it was $199 for the new edition. So we're talking today about minerals and mineral testing. We have the essential minerals, and we have the toxic minerals. The essential minerals are broken down into categories like macro minerals and micro minerals and trace minerals. So the macro minerals are ones we need larger amounts, like calcium and magnesium. And then we have the ones that we need lesser amounts, like iron and zinc. And then we have the ones that we need even tiny amounts, like selenium and chromium, etc. And in general, the amounts that we're, if you look at the like the RDAs for the different minerals, the macro minerals, the ones we need larger amounts of, we usually have a requirement in the hundreds of milligrams, in approaching 1,000 milligrams or a gram. The micronutrients we usually have a requirement for in the double digits, like 10, 15, 20 milligrams. And then the really trace elements that we only need teeny tiny amounts, our requirements are in the microgram amounts, really teeny tiny. So when we're looking at a person that's presenting with a variety of different health challenges, looking to get better through nutrition, we want to look at what can cause their low levels. If we suspect they have low levels, what are some of the factors that can cause low levels? So some of those factors are, of course, insufficient intake. If they're eating the standard American diet or some variation on that, consisting of a lot of processed foods, they're going to have insufficient intake. But they can also have insufficient intake if they're on a whole foods diet, just because the soils tend to be insufficient, and also if they have some either genetic or acquired conditions that use and require more of those minerals. So it's really important to look at intake and not be quick to judge, like, oh, you know, it looks like they're getting the RDA of minerals for this. Why is that a problem? It may be that that's insufficient for them. Okay, so that's the first reason they'll be low. Another one, though, is insufficient absorption. A lot of times I see people, they're taking in plenty of minerals, plenty of nutrients, but they don't have good absorption. And what this goes back to is our digestion. It's looking at their digestion. Do they have enough stomach acid? Stomach acid is vital for the absorption of minerals. You need to have good stomach acid. You need to have a low pH in order to be able to break apart the minerals from their carriers and absorb them in. An exception to that would be if you've got ionized minerals in a liquid form and had a person take them on an empty stomach. then it can oftentimes bypass that need for the high level of hydrochloric acid, and you can help to replenish the minerals so that you can make hydrochloric acid, because it's a catch-22, right? If you don't have enough minerals, you can't make enough hydrochloric acid. In particular, zinc's really important there. And if you don't have enough hydrochloric acid, you can't absorb your minerals. So sometimes you need to be supplementing in higher than you may desire quantities for a while to get that up, and working on their digestion. They may be getting enough, they may be absorbing it, but they may not be able to properly utilize it. That goes into various enzyme insufficiencies, pathways, that metabolic pathways that are blocked, either for genetic or acquired reasons. Increased use or need, I mentioned that at the beginning. They may need more, or they may be using more. Maybe they're an athlete and they're sweating like crazy and they're burning up like crazy and they need a lot of extra minerals to do that. Maybe they have some sort of an autoimmune disease. Increased use or increased need based on the metabolic profile of that person. Increased loss, that would also apply to the athlete, or somebody who's drinking a lot of water might be losing a lot. Somebody who's sweating a lot may be losing a lot. Somebody who's got internal bleeding might have increased loss. That's like when we have low iron, we always have to rule out increased loss through bleeding. And if they're not overtly bleeding, then we may be looking inside at internal bleeding, or in the case of a woman, looking at her periods to see if she having excessive bleeding during the periods where she's losing a lot of blood and thus a lot of iron. Interference, things that interfere, certain foods, certain nutrients interfere with each other. For example, if you have too much copper, it can interfere with the absorption and utilization of zinc and make you require more. So it's the ratios between certain foods have interferences. Like so in certain grains that are not sprouted or cooked will have inhibitors in there. They have phytic acid in grains will interfere with the absorption of minerals. Oxalic acid in things like spinach or rhubarb or chard can interfere with the absorption of calcium. So interference, it may look like on paper they're getting plenty. And it's your job at the very start to be looking at things when you're looking at every person that comes in. Is like, how's their intake, how's their absorption, how are they utilizing it, do they have an increased need or use or loss, and then what might be interfering. And this is true of minerals, but it's also true of vitamins, of essential fatty acids, of proteins. It's true of all the nutrients. So in addition to looking at a diet survey and looking at some of the needs, it's important to look at their symptoms and signs that may indicate that they have mineral deficiencies. I've provided you with an online mineral assessment. I call it the scorecard. The link there is in the slide presentation, and that's one of the mineral deficiency document. That's one that I put together for you, where you can go through that and you can just sit with a person and check it off, or be asking them questions and have it in front of you and check it off, really be looking for some of those signs. So if you start to see some signs of a particular mineral deficiency, you may be asking them about that. Mineral imbalances can affect their behaviors. They can affect their cravings. Sometimes pregnant women crave eating dirt, or they lick paint off the walls because they have minerals that they're trying to put in. They have cravings for certain foods. It's especially highlighted in pregnancy because things shift so much, right? You're growing a baby, but it can be true of anybody. If you see young children who are eating dirt or having a craving for certain foods, maybe that their body is trying to replenish some of the missing nutrients. And really looking at and assessing the quality of their nails, their hair, their bones, and their teeth. We tell you they've been to the dentist a lot, and they may be having some problems with calcium. They get sick a lot. That's another one of the things that you may be asking about. They may have a problem with zinc. So really looking and asking lots of questions is a critical piece to the beginning of mineral assessment. We don't run right in and get labs done. Even if somebody walks in and says, look, I have $20,000 to spend on my health and on my testing, what do you recommend? You still want to go through this piece first so that you could recommend just the tests that they really need, because if you get too many tests done, it's going to confuse the heck out of you. It can be really, really confusing. And medications as well, and the mineral assessment tools, because it's really important. And their stress levels, because stress levels can affect your mineral levels. And then you go to lab testing. Only then after you've really explored to see what might be going on. some mineral deficiencies are really easy to correct really quickly. Somebody has a magnesium deficiency, and this is a person that lives on bread and junk food and carbs and stuff. You don't have to go very far to figure out that they're not getting magnesium in their diet, because magnesium is really high in your green leafy vegetables. They're not getting them. So it's really easy sometimes to see that in their diet. Let's look at lab testing. So what are some of the lab testing that's available to you should you determine that this person needs it? So we're going to be looking at the toxic and the essentials. The toxic's really important because those toxic elements can be affecting their brain function. It can be affecting their overall function. It can be affecting them dramatically in ways that they're not getting better when you do what you know makes most people better. They may have a heavy metal burden that we need to find out about. And then there's the essential minerals. I will start this whole thing off by saying there's a lot of controversy. If you go online and you start to read about mineral testing in the hair and urine and blood, there's a lot of bickering and arguing. I'm going to give you the information about what's available and what's recommended as the best places for testing each individual mineral based on my sources. You may find that in your experience there's some other lab test that does something better, or that in your experience blood works better than hair or urine in a particular nutrient, even though I said one thing. As you explore, as you get experience, you may find things that are different, and each individual person things are going to be a little bit different. So use this as a starting point, a launching off point. I've given you a lot of information, the background information, as always, so that you can make your own decisions. I've given you documents from each of the lab companies on the various tests. And the book that I really highly recommend for all the functional testing in detail is Laboratory Evaluation in Molecular Medicine, and it's by Alexander Browley. It's a good big hunk of a book. It's about 350, 360 pages. It's got a lot of really nice charts and descriptions and pictures and flow charts, which you know me, I love those biochemical flow charts. A lot of charts, a lot of flow charts, and a lot of text describing the various functional things that we've been doing. And it's really a great reference as you're pulling up a test and you want to go back and learn more about it. However, just having the book doesn't really do the trick if you haven't been familiar with the test, if you don't have the lab reports in front of you. So I find that the book is more important to me after I've done a couple of the tests, or when I have a test result in front of me rather than reading it in advance. So that's just the way I learn. Not all methods are created equal. Some of them are better, and some are better for certain nutrients, and others are better for others. And that's why I've given you, we have a page for each of the minerals that we can go through and determine. So blood chemistry and electrolyte indicators. So your general blood chemistry, there are some clues about, indirect clues about mineral imbalances there. And then there are electrolyte indicators, and there's things like calcium and iron, and we'll go through in more detail. But that's one place that you can be testing things. Your standard blood chemistry gives you a few clues. Measuring blood levels of minerals, that gives you some clues. But it's usually not the straight serum, like the blood chemistry is done. Better is usually testing the blood cells themselves. Some tests test the white blood cells, some test the red blood cells, and we'll look at what's most effective for each of them. So the blood cells, that's the next one, the blood cells. That could be white blood cells, red blood cells, or whole blood. Hair testing. Generally, hair testing is recognized as a really good way to test for toxics. Not necessarily essentials, but for some essentials, you can get good readings in the hair. There are a lot of hair testing companies out there that produce these beautiful 20-page reports that have all these, this ratio and that ratio. And the problem is, if you run the test through several different labs, you get different reports with different explanations of the findings. There's a lot of controversy over there. I would rather not go with all that. That's somebody else's interpretation, and based on this, you should eat that. If you find that helpful, go for it. If you do it on a few people, go for it. I've done it on myself in the past, and it just thoroughly confused me, the report, and I thought, what would this do to a patient? I'd rather be able to give them the report, explain to them what things are in balance, what things are out of balance, and especially is good for the toxics. And then taste testing. That's not universally accepted, although there's good evidence for the validity of it. those of you who were at the Spring Into Vitality event, we actually got to do the taste testing. A company called Body Bio created these tester vials for the different minerals. They've gotten 8 of them. They've been very careful and thorough in their way of approaching it. They correlate it with symptoms and blood levels and whatever this gold standard is for particular nutrients. And once they've done hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of tests and they feel confident that it's repeatable, then they will put it out there and say it's a tester. They currently have 8 minerals that you can test via taste testing. They are magnesium, potassium, manganese, chromium, copper, molybdenum, and selenium. Anyway, those are the ones you can get those testing in every resource sheet where you can buy the kit. The kit runs under $100, and you can essentially run that on as many clients, like quite a number of clients. And you can actually, if you're doing long distance stuff, you can actually encourage your client to get that if they show up that you suspect they have some mineral imbalances, and it gives them an idea and a gauge as to which minerals they could test. It's the most inexpensive way to test for minerals. Stool testing is very controversial. Dr. Amy Yasko uses stool testing, but she also uses the others. She's very big on helping people to remove their minerals, and so she does the stool testing after she's put them on a process. She doesn't use it to detect whether they have a heavy metal burden. For that, she uses the hair and the challenged urine, which we'll talk about in a moment. For the stool testing, she uses it to test whether they're dumping properly. So if you're putting somebody on a protocol to get rid of heavy metals, which I encourage you to do cautiously, then they should be eliminating those in the stool. And you want them to be eliminating those in the stool, because if they're not, then some of those are getting recycled. So the stool testing is good for seeing it going up. So she'll look at a test result and she'll say, yay, look at that, your mercury is really high. She's celebrating the fact that the mercury in the stool is high. And she'll do it again a few months later. And if it's higher, she knows that it's still eliminating. And then when it goes high and then starts to come back down, she knows that either the person's not doing the things to eliminate, or they've reduced their body burden significantly. So the stool testing is controversial for the initial testing, but it's used very effectively by some practitioners for keeping track of how well people are excreting their heavy metals. And then there's urine testing. So there's a whole big bunch of articles on Quackbusters, Quackwatch and Quackbusters. And I always feel like if you make Quackbusters, you're probably doing a good job in alternative medicine, because they are just a bunch of very closed-minded people who are always trying to put down. They poo-poo acupuncture, they poo-poo chiropractic, they poo-poo herbs. You know, the only thing that's really valid is conventional blood testing and drugs. And that's what they believe in. And anybody who does anything else, they put. So they put doctor's data, big deal on doctor's data. They're constantly saying that these urine tests are crazy. And big deal. But the urine testing is used very effectively by a lot of practitioners to help to figure out what the burden is and how well they are eliminating. So you can do an unchallenged urine test, where you just take the person and see how many toxic metals are in their urine. And when you look at that, if they have high levels in an unchallenged urine, it means that those are affecting them on a daily basis. Those are circulating on a daily basis. If they don't, I always like to do the unchallenged followed by the challenged. Sometimes it's hard to convince people because they have to spend the extra $100 to do it twice. But I like to do it challenged, unchallenged, and then challenged. So then you give them a chelation agent. It could be suppositories of UDTA. It could be DMSA orally. You could have them go in for an EDTA IV. There's a number of ways that you can challenge them. What I recommend is pick your challenge method and use it for any follow-ups, because if you change your challenge method, you're going to get different results. So then you give them this chelating agent, you collect their urine for 6 hours after that. Usually it's 6 hours, it might be a little bit longer if you use EDTA suppositories, I think that's 8 or 12 hours. And then you test the urine again. You send it off to the lab and they look and they compare. So if you had low levels of all your minerals when you are unchallenged, and then you have high levels when you're challenged, what that means is that challenging agent pulled some of those minerals out of storage. The Quackbusters want you to believe that, well, if there's none in the urine to begin with, then leave the person alone. But the problem is, a lot of these folks who are doing this are experiencing things like autism, like brain fog, like multiple sclerosis and other neurologic diseases. So the metals are being stored and sequestered away in body tissue where it can be causing harm. And when you do the challenge, you're pulling it out of storage and you're testing it. You do have to be careful in people who are super sensitive and who have very impaired pathways of detoxification, people with the methylation issue. So urine, it tends to be used a lot by people who are trying to work with people to get rid of their heavy metals. And it, like I said, unchallenged or challenged. So then you can do loading tests. Iodine loading test is a famous one, but you can do a magnesium loading test. You can do a zinc loading test, where you do a pre-urine, you test the levels of that mineral, then you do a loading of that mineral. You take a whole bunch of it, and then you test after. And the amount that's excreted in proportion to the amount that you took and compared to the amount that you had pre gives you an idea of the status of how well in balance that person is. There are lots of opinions, there are lots of controversies, and there are lots of quack watcher activities based on mineral testing. The iodine test, but the skin testing. And that's usually just done for iodine. Okay. So now what we're going to do is we're going to go through each of your minerals, not your toxics, your essentials. We'll talk about toxins as a big lump sum. And we're going to give you an idea of what are the best ways to test for these. What are the tried and true accepted ways for testing for these? So if you do a serum magnesium, which sometimes people do at Direct Labs, doesn't include it anymore, they used to, but LabCorp can run it, it's misleading because low could mean a deficiency, and it most likely does. If it's really low in the serum, it likely is a deficiency. But a high level does not mean that you're sufficient, a normal or high level. It's similar to vitamin B12. Generally speaking, if you get vitamin B12 done in your serum, and it's low, you most likely have a deficiency, especially if you have an MCV that's high. However, when you have a B12 that's high, doesn't mean that you have enough, because there's a lot of things. Remember, we talked about all the reasons for having mineral insufficiencies. There may be enough, but it's not being converted properly. So that's the same thing. If you have low GGT, gamma to transferase, I can't remember exactly the words that they're all gobbled together, but it's a liver enzyme, and it's a transferase. If it's low, it could reflect magnesium deficiency because that transferase enzyme is magnesium dependent. So if it's low, usually we're looking for GGT high. It's high in alcoholics and people who have liver impairment. And most medical practitioners don't even bother looking if any of the transferase enzymes are low. But we as functional practitioners look at low transferase enzymes as an indication that perhaps the cofactor is low. And the GGT has a cofactor of magnesium. So these are indirect ways to test. RBC levels, the red cell membranes, are more accurate. You might see RBC mineral testings listed as erythrocyte. Erythrocyte's another name for red blood cells. RBC is red blood cells. So you look at your red blood cell levels, that's more accurate indicator for magnesium. When you look at the hair for magnesium, high concentrations may represent that you're mobilizing magnesium from the bone to correct low tissue levels. So if you do a hair test on somebody, you say, wow, look at them, they have so much magnesium, they're way off the charts, it's more likely to be that it's a low level of magnesium, right? That they're mobilizing bone, storage from bone, and then it's being eliminated in the hair. And then finally, low levels of magnesium in the hair are not necessarily meaningful. They haven't been able to correlate low levels of magnesium in the hair to deficiency signs, symptoms, and other like the red blood cells, which are really the gold standard. And finally, urine. Urine, again, can be unchallenged or with a magnesium load. It's a good indicator of deficiency if it's low in the urine because the kidney tubules will reabsorb if you're low. The problem is it's not going to reflect necessarily a long-standing problem. It is more likely to be a recent problem. So, you know, over the last week or so, you've had some magnesium, low magnesium intake, and your kidneys are reabsorbing more, so you have low levels in the urine. So it may not reflect something that's long-term. Hair tends to reflect things that are a little bit more long-term. although not necessarily current, right? Because the hair, it takes time to grow out. And so the hair, while it will reflect more of a long range level, it will reflect more in the, you know, further back, like 6 weeks ago, right? When that hair first started to come through. And then we have the magnesium load. It's most frequently done with an IV mag sulfate, 2 milliliters in a 50% solution. And then you compare the pre and post magnesium in the urine. You can do oral as well, but it tends to be less accurate because there's things that may be interfering with the absorption of that magnesium in your system. Okay, so it's low, it can give you an indication that your body may not be getting enough magnesium because of lack of absorption. So let's look at calcium. Calcium is not as easy to test as one might think, because the serum levels are tightly regulated. If you have a high serum level or a low serum level of calcium, it usually means something much more serious than a calcium deficiency. All right, calcium will go high in parathyroid symptoms and also vitamin D deficiency, or vitamin D excess actually. And vitamin D deficiency will cause a problem with low calcium. So, but really there's a tight control. It's not gonna be very much off, because it's so important for cardiac rhythms, right? So low or high calcium in the serum is a serious problem. It's not necessarily indicative of a deficiency of calcium though. Urine is good for monitoring therapies. This is a list of biomarkers for calcium. I actually put the list to the original document, but it's also included on your sheet. It just shows you all the different ways, and this is it's a paper. It's a long paper, and it was done to see what kind of biomarkers. But it's kind of a, what did they call it, a preview kind of paper. It hasn't been published yet, but it's up to be published. So that's the calcium urine biomarkers. And urine tends to be a good way to monitor therapy. Like, if you just do the urine levels and you look at them and calcium's low or high, it may not be as indicative as you would like their status. But if you start to give them calcium, kind of like the loading thing, you give them calcium and you measure it. You measure what's called whether they're a negative or positive calcium balance based on the amount that you give them. And that's a good way to measure. Hair is elevated in deficiency states, similar to the way magnesium is. If it's high in the hair, it means that your body's probably mobilizing things from the bone to make up for a deficiency state. So that's one thing. If it's high, there's actually a high correlation to abnormal glucose tolerance. And I'm not sure how that plays in, but there have been some studies that say that there's a high correlation of the hair levels of calcium to your glucose tolerance. An indirect measure of calcium would be your bone density and your NTX. Bone density actually measures how thick your bone is. Of course, it could be related to things other than calcium, right? It could be related to boron, strontium, magnesium. There's 20 different nutrients that go into making healthy bone. But low bone density can be an indicator of low calcium. And the NTX test, which is the bone turnover rate, can be an indication of calcium. You got to be careful in supplementing calcium. There's been a lot of research over the last few years that talk about calcifications and how excess calcium, especially inorganic, inert calcium, non-food form calcium, in supplements, which people are taking by the handful, can actually start to cause calcifications, which can form in joints and in various places in your body and in your blood vessels. So it's really important to make sure that you're not overdoing on calcium, but of course you want to make sure that you have enough calcium. Iron is measured in your blood. Iron is, you know, almost completely measured. There's no other places that iron is really accurately measured. So I just stuck with the blood. And there's a bunch of signs of iron deficiency or excess, the way that you measure iron status. First of all, ferritin is your storage. And it's going to get low when your levels of iron are starting to drop. Even if your serum iron still looks good, you can detect an upcoming iron deficiency by looking at the ferritin. The storage starts to go down. TIBC is the total iron binding capacity. So there's a protein that binds iron and carries it around, and it's called transferrin. So transferrin is binding your iron. So the total iron binding capacity is how much is left over, how much binding capacity is left over. If there's very little, it means that you probably have quite a good amount of iron in your body. If the TIBC is very high, it usually means that your iron is low and it's not actually taking up residence on those binding sites. Transferrin. Transferrin saturation is actually the ratio of how much iron you have in your serum to the total iron binding capacity. That means that if your transferrin saturation is high, you've got some good levels of iron. If your transferrin saturation is low, it means that you're probably low in iron. Then you have the plasma iron itself, which is actually the circulating iron that's available to bind with the other nutrients and form hemoglobin, the molecule. So hemoglobin is the oxygen carrying capacity. It's low in iron insufficiency, but low hemoglobin does not necessarily mean you have iron insufficiency. It can be low in other things like B12 or folate or vitamin C or B6 deficiency. Hematocrit is the percentage of the blood that the RBCs, the red blood cells, represent. So if that number is high, it should be in the, say, the mid-40s, so anywhere from 38 to 45 for women and up to 49 or so for men. If it's good, if it's in a healthy range, that means that you've got a lot of good red blood cells, and that's your oxygen carrying capacity in your blood. But if it's low, it suggests that we don't have enough iron to be able to create enough of the red blood cells carrying iron around for you. So that's a sign of an iron deficiency anemia. But again, it can be other things. The MCV is the size of the blood cells. When you don't have enough iron, your blood cells are small, and that's called microcytic anemia. So that's one clue. But if you recall, MCV in isolation doesn't give you all the information you need. You can have a normal MCV, mean corpuscular volume, when you have a superimposed iron deficiency, which causes a microcytic anemia, small red blood cells, superimposed with a macrocytic anemia, which would be like a folic acid or B12 type of anemia. And they can average out to be a nice small. And if you remember, there's the RDW, which indicates that you have some sort of anemia, not specific to iron at all. Then there's something that we don't generally hear about or talk about much. It's called zinc protoporphyrin. And zinc protoporphyrin accumulates when heme is inhibited by lack of iron. So it's an indirect measure of iron insufficiency. So you can see that iron is really easy to test for deficiency, unlike many of the other minerals. So let's look at zinc. We know that zinc is important for so many different functions, for the immune system, for the cardiovascular system, for the reproductive system, for digestion, for brain function. Zinc is ubiquitous, meaning it's all over the place. And so how do we measure zinc status? One of the tests that has been a functional medicine test for many years that sometimes gets some flack as to whether it really is accurate is the zinc taste test. And you basically take a solution of zinc sulfate, you mix it with water, they put it in a bottle, it's a certain concentration, and then you take a teaspoon of that, swish it around in your mouth. If it tastes really gross, it means that you don't need it. If it tastes really great, it means that you probably need it, because zinc affects the taste receptors. And then BodyBio took that a step further. Not only did they do zinc, but they patented how to test these for other minerals. Well, let's look at blood. When you look at the blood, only 0.5% of the total body zinc is found in the blood. So would the blood levels of zinc really mean anything? It's not really reflective of the whole body burden, the whole body stores, I should say, of zinc. Plasma is not a good indicator, because it's influenced by so many factors. The level of zinc can be influenced by steroids, by various hormones. In the red blood cells, in the membranes, there's 10 times more zinc than in plasma. So if you look at the red blood cells, the erythrocyte metals, the erythrocyte zinc, and you can do a test that's all erythrocyte elements, and most of the labs have it. We'll show you that later. So it's 10 times more, and it's much more accurate assessment of your zinc status. And then if you also, an indirect way to look in the blood is to look at alkaline phosphatase. There are other zinc-containing enzymes, but the most popular, the one that's almost always run on lab tests, routine lab tests, is alkaline phosphatase. It's a zinc-dependent enzyme. So if alkphos is low, it could mean that you don't have enough zinc. With urine, again, there's a 24-hour and a loading. It's considered a decent way to measure zinc. It's not the best. The RBC is the best, but it certainly can give you an indication. And then hair can be misleading because it can only reflect short-term status. There's a lot of false negatives for deficiency. Okay, you may think that you don't that you're fine because of the zinc status, and they've turned out that when they correlated it with other things, that hair wasn't a very good sign of zinc status. So let's look at copper. You know that copper and zinc are antagonists. If you have too much copper, it decreases your zinc levels and vice versa. So one of your assessment tools is to look at how much copper they have versus zinc, because that can give you some clues as to their status. So serum. You're only going to see low levels of copper in the serum with very severe deficiency. It's not going to help you to detect subtle deficiency. The copper in the serum is bound to ceruloplasmin, so you can't really measure it. Just by measuring copper, you have to really measure the ceruloplasmin. And ceruloplasmin is a protein, a copper-carrying protein. Copper is increased in infection, inflammation, and estrogen excess, like if the person's on oral contraceptives, if they are on hormone replacement therapy, if they have a high body burden of exogenous xenoestrogens. Copper is also decreased by steroids, like corticosteroids, when you ingest them or put them on the skin, and also your own endogenous production of cortisol. So copper has a lot of things that interfere with the levels in the serum. If you have low hemoglobin and hematocrit, it might be low copper, so that's an indirect sign in the blood. In the red blood cell, copper is much more accurately measured. And also you can measure SOD in the red blood cell, superoxide dismutase, which is a copper-dependent enzyme. And that gives you an indirect look at how your copper is doing. You can also measure ceruloplasmin. And ceruloplasmin can be measured in the serum or their blood cells. Some of these tests, I didn't look up to see how expensive these are. I haven't run ceruloplasmin, so I don't know if it's in one of those real expensive esoteric tests or if it's just $20. But that's certainly an option if you're trying to discover a copper. But really, hair is generally considered a good indicator of copper status, except with two exceptions. Wilson's, which is a copper storage disease, which is too much copper being stored in the liver. If they have that, it's a genetic disease, then the copper in the hair is not going to be accurate. And then contamination. You know, if there's copper in the pipes and in the water because you're not drinking pure water, or the containers that you carry the water in are contaminated, then the hair is not going to be a good source of copper. Again, the best you're probably going to do is run a whole panel. You're going to run an RBC panel or a urine panel, and most of the labs have that. And urine is definitely not indicative of the body's stores. Chromium. We know chromium is a super important nutrient, right? It's super important for your blood glucose regulation. And plasma is not a good indicator because the concentration is less than 1 part per million. So it's not going to be a good indicator of how much you have. Urine can be a valid indicator as long as the person's taking in more than 40 micrograms a day. If they're taking less than 40 micrograms a day, then the amount in the urine that's going to get excreted is just not going to give you a good reflection of the tissue storage. The hair is 100 times the concentration of blood. Seems to be a reliable indicator of the status of chromium. Your red blood cells, aka erythrocytes, you'll see that I alternated that between slides. Sometimes I said erythrocytes and sometimes I said RBCs. There's a 20-fold higher concentration than in the serum. So when you do the red blood cell minerals, the chromium is going to be pretty accurate. And the last one is a test that most people are not going to want to do, right? And that's a tissue biopsy. And that's a tissue biopsy of glucose transporting cells. So you can go in and do a muscle biopsy, for example. You can do a liver biopsy and see how well what's the status of the chromium in there, because the chromium is important to be in those cell receptors so that it can help transport the glucose and the insulin across the urine. So let's look at selenium. The red blood cells seem to be the best place to measure selenium. Most selenium is associated with an enzyme called glutathione peroxidase. And when they do studies to see how the clinical improvements correspond to the red blood cell selenium, it's very positive. So they'll supplement somebody, measure their red blood cell selenium, supplement somebody, then measure it again, and then watch for clinical improvements. We know that selenium is important in a lot of different places. Of course, it's important in this a glutathione peroxidase enzyme, which means it's important in antioxidants, important in cancer prevention. It's also important in the thyroid, right? We looked at how it's important in the thyroid for converting from T4, the form that your thyroid gland makes, into T3, which is the active form. You will see, if you're measuring selenium, don't measure the red blood cells in cystic fibrosis or Downs, because it's just naturally going to be lower. You need to know they're going to be lower, and you just need to supplement those people. As far as hair, selenium does seem to correlate. So if the levels are in the hair, it indicates that the selenium is good. If the levels are low, it indicates that it's deficient. Again, if you're working with somebody who's really sick and you're having difficulties, you may be measuring these minerals in different places. That's what Amy Yasko does with her very sick patients. She works with autistic kids and people with really serious fibromyalgia and autoimmunes. And then functionally, well, you just kind of look and you look at their thyroid. If they look like they have a lot more T4 than T3, they're not converting properly, or they're going from T4 down to reverse T3. They may not have enough selenium. And if they appear to have a thyroid receptor problem, they may not have enough selenium. So that's suggestive. So we're always looking at ways that we can objectively and subjectively evaluate. And we want there to be some correlation between them. We don't want them to look like objectively they have some signs of this deficiency, but they look very fine when you look objectively. You just have to balance it all out. Iodine. Serum is a poor indicator of tissue and functional status. It just doesn't work. The best way to measure iodine is through the urine, an iodine loading test. You do a pre and post. You measure the iodine baseline. Then you take a dose of about 50 milligrams of iodine. Usually you take a half, it's not quite half and half, but it's iodine and iodide, potassium iodide. And you measure. The other thing that I like to do with the iodine loading test is do the halides test, because that looks for iodine antagonists. And we know that bromine, fluorine, and chlorine interfere with the uptake of iodine, interfere with that. It binds to iodine sites and causes problems instead of helping you. The red blood cell iodine doesn't seem to be reliable. The hair iodine does not seem to be reliable. It's included on a lot of the hair tests, but it doesn't seem to be reliable, so don't even pay attention to it. And then the functional indicators. If the person has indicators for primary hypothyroidism, both in the blood, like their TSH is high, their T4 is either normal or low, and that is an indicator of possible iodine deficiency. And if they have all the signs and symptoms of hypothyroidism, like sluggishness and sluggish bowels and dry hair and skin and losing their hair, that kind of stuff. The skin testing for iodine, you know, that the thing where you take the liquid iodine, you paint a patch on. I did that test for years, and I'd been to seminars, they said it was, there's a lot of controversy. So I don't know what the right answer is, whether that iodine, it'd be nice to do a test where you do the iodine load test with people and you do the skin. The idea with the skin test is you paint a patch of iodine on the skin, and if the body needs the iodine, if you're low in iodine, you absorb that, and you absorb it more quickly the more you need. But the problem has been that it can evaporate. Another problem is on people with dark skin, it's really hard to tell, so you don't really know how long it's lasting. So it's controversial. You can try it. It is a good, like, you know, screening thing. I've done it. I don't necessarily do it all that much anymore. We have potassium. Serum is a poor indicator of tissue and functional status. It just doesn't work well. Urine excretion seems to be correlated with intake. So if you eat a lot of potassium, take a lot of supplements, the urine will reflect that. So, which means that the urine can be a good way to measure it. The red blood cells, again, seems to be the best indicator, good indicator of the total body potassium. I didn't put hair down, but hair doesn't seem to be at all something that potassium is going to be a good way to measure. Another way that you look at functionally potassium, if the person is very acidic, they could have a decreased pH, like a 5.2 is their urine or saliva pH. That means that they've got a body burden or a low body store of the alkaline minerals. So if you supplement with potassium and it causes them to increase their pH, then you know that that was an indicator for them that the potassium was low. And then there's whole blood, and it's similar. You can do it on whole blood versus RBCs, and you do get similar. So manganese, Whole blood is a good indicator. Red blood cells, erythrocytes, is a good indicator. Hair, though, just seems to be good for toxicity. If you have an excess of manganese, if manganese poisoning, hair is good as well as urine. So the best indicators in terms of manganese, the most available is probably the erythrocyte, the red blood cell manganese level. And I'll show you where you can get those tests. And then we have vanadium. Urine's a good indicator, hair's a good indicator. So either way tends to be a good indicator for vanadium, whether it's high or low. And from a functional standpoint, if the person has really long-standing insulin resistance, sometimes vanadium is just what they need to pull them out of it. So it may be that they do have a vanadium deficiency. Vanadium molybdenum. I heard somebody say molybdenum. I say molybdenum. It was interesting to hear different people say things differently. So as a seminar over the weekend, and one of the speakers talked about methionine, and somebody called it, so something like methionine. I don't know. I was like, what is he talking about? Oh, methionine, yes. So we all have slightly different ways to say these really big mouthful words. Molybdenum is how I say it, molybdenum. It tends to be concentrated in hair because we have sulfhydryl groups that bind the hair, and the molybdenum sense tends to gravitate towards sulfhydryl groups. So it will be more concentrated in hair, and it could be an indicator of your total body, whether you have too much of it or you have insufficiency. From a functional standpoint, though, low uric acid is very often correlated with low molybdenum. And then high xanthine, which we don't normally measure, but it could be measured, and that's usually reflective of low uric acid. But low uric acid is generally what's monitored in all the standard blood testing, so it's easy. It's an easy indicator. What's molybdenum good for? There is a chart on the page that I gave you that will tell you what these things are good for. It's this mineral testing, okay. But the books that I gave you will give you that stuff, so if you want to be able to look. So those are the main ways of testing our nutrients. So what I wanted to look at was the reliability of your routine blood test. And this is all just summarized. We've gone over this before, but which ones are good and which ones are not. So you have it all in one sheet. Calcium, not a good indicator. Potassium, not a good indicator of tissue status. Not a good indicator of tissue status, but it is a valid and important piece for the measurement of your electrolyte levels and the sodium and potassium balance, and that's what's good in the blood. Sodium is reliable, chloride is reliable, phosphorus is reliable, so standard blood tests are reliable there. Iron, definitely reliable. Molybdenum, like I said, indirect. Uric acid suggests low molybdenum. Selenium, it's indirect. You can look at the thyroid. And zinc is indirect, you can look at the alkaline phosphatase. So overall, you can get an indicator of some of these top nutrients, some of these top minerals, just from doing a standard routine blood test. Okay, so functionally or serum-wise, but you can also run other kinds of tests. So let's look at hair testing for toxic elements. There's a lot of controversy as to whether hair testing is any good at all for the levels of your essential minerals. And we talked as we went through each of those that some of them, like magnesium and calcium, when it's high in the hair, it indicates a deficiency. Others, only when it's high does it make sense, and when it's low, it doesn't necessarily mean a deficiency. So they're all a little bit different. And some of the people that do the hair testing will have you believe that it gives you the best insights into the body, and I don't see how they calculate some of their things. So it just requires a little bit more forethought and experimentation. The EPA wrote a 300-page review of 400 studies of hair in 1979, and they concluded that hair is a meaningful and representative tissue for biological monitoring of the most toxic metals. So there you go, okay? So let's look at fecal mineral testing. That's more controversial than anything. Although Dr. Yasko uses it to monitor her autistic kids, she gets good results, but she doesn't use it as a baseline to determine deficiency or sufficiency. She uses it to determine the efficacy of what she's doing. And she uses it in combination, which I think might be the best way to go. Might be a little bit more expensive to do it that way, right? They're having to spend more money but depends on how severe their situation is, it might be a good idea to do a multiple combination. And we'll look at some of the reports so you get an idea of what you see and what's done. So fecal metal testing is excellent for evaluating the ability to excrete. And if you're putting somebody on a metal excretion program, a metal chelating program, it's a good idea to do this. And just as an aside, I just want to put in again the warning that before you put somebody on a metal chelation program, whether it's oral or you send them to a chelation doctor to do it, you got to make sure that their methylation pathways are opened up, that their detoxification pathways are opened up. Or what you do is they pull them out of storage and then they restore them back in. And in the meantime, they're in the bloodstream causing all kinds of problems. So people can get really sick and then their liver says, sorry, got to put these back where they came from. So it can be a waste of time. They're also, like I said, good for monitoring the metal detox. And the fecal tests are the only one I found that do them is Doctor's Data. The hair test, the RBC test, the urine test are all done by many labs, and I have references for you. But the fecal metal testing seems to be only done by Doctor's Data. So here's a chart that is the normal ideal levels of toxic metals in the hair, how much you should have. And this came from this site, Detecting Metals. He tends to be a little bit more conservative than the average test results. You can go by what the lab says. You can look at the sample reports I've given you and compare to see if the ranges are indeed the same and how they compare to this one. We're looking at ballpark. As one of my clients said when she got back, her MD had run a urine test, and she came back with the levels of different metals. And he said, oh, that's okay, that's within range. She goes, no, you don't understand. I want zero. I don't want to have just a little bit of lead, you know, because she had some were zero. But she says, I don't want to have any. I want to get rid of this. And some of them, of course, she had high. But it's really the idea is how many bullets do you really want shooting at your body, right? One other test that I want to share with you. Again, I haven't done this much. I've talked to the folks at it. It's extremely expensive. It's like $600 and some. It's a lymphocyte test, and it's for nutrients, and they call it the micronutrient panel. And it tests everything. The only minerals it tests are calcium, magnesium, manganese, zinc, and copper. But it also tests for a host of vitamins and antioxidants and fats. And it could be a good test to do if you want to get a general idea for somebody. But like I said, it's a good $600 test. It's very expensive. So unless you've got somebody who has good insurance to pay for it, they may not be willing to right off the top do it. Okay. I know the Hippocrates Institute uses this test. They think it's a very good test. So a lot of people that I respect use this test. I'm not saying it's not a good test. It's just if you're looking specifically at minerals, it only measures a few of them, and we have other ways that we can measure it. But if you want to do the full panel and test them of all their micronutrients, you certainly can. So some of the labs that you can use to do these tests. The red blood cell urine and hair are done by Great Plains, Doctor's Data, Genova, and Metametrics. The feces are done by Doctor's Data. The taste test kits you can get by that link, drreedandmarie.com/go/mineral tests. There's a shortcut link for a link that didn't even fit on the page. That's those body bio mineral tests, the taste test kits. And it may be worthwhile to have those. I just purchased a couple of extra sets of those. Lab access. So for practitioner only, Metametrics and Genova and Doctor's Data, they won't take orders unless you are a practitioner. Usually it's a doctor, a naturopath, so it would be an MD, DC, ND, OD, those kind of things. You can always call them and try to set up an account, but you don't really need to. It's really great these days that there's direct access. Direct Labs definitely has these tests, and the link is there. Great Plains usually uses Doctor's Data, but Great Plains you can access on your own direct. There's another lab called Accessa Labs, and then another one I just found out recently, labtestingdirect.com. Lab Testing Direct's a little bit more expensive than the others. However, it does some of the tests that you can't get through the others. It does some of the C-Rex labs, which are more immune system allergy type labs, but still it does those tests as well that you normally can't get. So here's a list of some of my favorite books. Jeffrey Bland's book is just a little bitty thing on the hair analysis. It's okay. It's not phenomenal. You know, it's got some good information in it, and it's just short and sweet. It might not be much more than you can get on the internet if you know where to look. I like The Healing Power of Minerals, Special Nutrients, and Trace Elements by Paul Bergner, because it's a really user-friendly kind of book. And the way he's got it organized, you've got sections. You've got a section for each of the minerals, and then you've got what foods they're included in, what functions they have, what are some of the signs of deficiencies. And it's just a nice little book, and it's got a lot of other interesting stuff in there as well. And it's inexpensive. You probably can pick it up used on Amazon for $10 or $12. Same thing with the Hair Tissue Mineral Analysis by Bland. You probably can get it on Amazon for $3, so certainly worth it. Minerals, Trace Minerals, and Human Health by Schaus. Again, that's a pretty good overall book that talks about all the minerals. And that one's it's kind of old, so it may be a little bit out of date. Hair Interpretation Findings, Hidden Toxicity. That's a book I haven't seen yet, but as I was researching some things, I found this book online, and it looks very thorough. And there was a couple of chapters from it on Google Books, the online books. There were a couple of sections that I wanted to look at weren't there. But anyway, you can look at some of the topics. I got it at his site, so I looked up this guy because it was really expensive on Amazon. It was $35 on his site. So I've got it on order. And then Laboratory Evaluation in Molecular Medicine. It's a pricey book. It's a textbook. It's a hardcover. You can get it through Metametrics, or you can get it online at Amazon. You might be able to find one used. But I really, really like it because he's really good at explaining how all the tests work and the flow charts and all of that. So these are some of the resources for you. How can we determine that the methylation pathways are indeed open and functioning before detox? It's not always possible to know that. But know that you're doing the right things to open them up and support them. You'll know it if you have a really sensitive person and they start to have really uncomfortable symptoms and then you know to back off. But you just want to be giving everything that you can give to, if they have specific methylation defects like the MTHFR stuff, you want to make sure you're giving them the methyl donors. I would probably have them do a really good diet beforehand, really build up to the good diet. You know, lots of greens and sea vegetables, and make sure their omega-3 fats are in order. So really building them up before you do a heavy metal detox. Really build up their nutritional status, and then if they do have any of these methylation defects, go for it. If you have somebody who's really chronically been ill and having a hard time with getting over it, I would highly recommend you do the genetics testing. 23andMe.com or SpectraCell does the MTHFRs, but I'd like to see that person have some indication of what their genetics are before you put them through a detox, because you can make them feel worse. And the sample report sits right at the bottom of your page. Sample reports. Let's look at the urine elements, show you what they give. This one is from Genova. All the labs show them a little bit differently. You look at the reference ranges. The results are in micrograms per 24 hours. And you look at the toxics in this particular case, these toxics are in a nice low range, right? They're really low, and that's good. Although this person has gadolinium and gallium, I would be looking at those are kind of odd ones, and platinum. What's going on this person? Is this person a miner or something? It's kind of odd to have that. And then, wow, these have some really unusual ones. Not all of the labs have this big array. So you'd be looking at what are the toxic ones, and then you look down here at, okay, this one says, oh, niobium is a common trace element in food and drink with notable levels in tea. I never heard of that one before. Platinum is above the reference range. It tells you a little bit more where you can find it. Food or drink is rare. Most exposures are industrial. So I said, what is this person, a miner, via inhalation or chemotherapy? Okay. So you would look through and see what ones are elevated for your person and where some of the sources are. You may be doing some research. You may be going online or pulling out some books to see, okay, where could they be getting this and how do we reduce the toxic burden? You don't want to just draw them out of their system. You want to get rid of whatever the exposure is and find out if it's an ongoing exposure or if this is just there from having been there before. This is a 24-hour report. It says it up at the top. And let's see if it says whether it's challenged or unchallenged. Yeah, so we don't know. This was 24 hours, but the provocation comment, it says information regarding provocation was not provided. So this was probably a straight one without the provocation, or it would have been provided, like this was a challenged with EDTA or whatever. So what do we have that's outside of the range? We have some in the yellow range, we have some in the, and notice on the yellow side, right, that unless there's at zero, right, they put it at yellow. They don't have a green range. Green range is that line straight down at zero. And this person does have a little bits of some others. Like she has a little bit of mercury, he or she. A little bit of mercury, a little bit of lead. So, and know that when you do some kind of metal chelation to get rid of it, you're going to help with all of them. But the only thing is you're also going to draw out some of the essential minerals. So you got to be really careful in putting somebody on some sort of a chelation program for minerals, because you can pull out the essential minerals. And if they tend to be low, you want to make sure that you're supplementing with those minerals during any kind of chelation, whether it's oral or they're going to the doctor for an IV. You want to make sure that you're replenishing. So in this particular case, the person has really high levels of chromium, cobalt. You'd be going back and marking off which of these are going to be useful in the urine and which aren't. It's a valid indicator. So she's high. This person may be taking in too much chromium, right? Cobalt is high. Copper is high. Iron is a little on the low side, but we said iron wasn't. It doesn't really mean much of anything. Lithium is very high. Is this person taking lithium? Manganese is pretty high. There's a lot of stuff going on with this person. They have a lot of it. Now you'll read what that means, right? Calcium is above the reference range. It could be glomerular, which means in the kidney tubules. Gallium is above the range. It tells you a little bit about that, where it can be stored, etc. Let's see. Lithium is above the range. The most frequent use is therapeutic use. Maybe this person is on. Dr. Yasko uses a lot of lithium in her treatment. Not a lot high doses, but she does use lithium a lot with her people. So if they're on a therapeutic trial of lithium, that may be why. So there's a lot of things you'd be asking this person about what they're taking if you don't already know it, and find out why they have such high exposures. Modified citrus pectin. And it doesn't pull out the essentials. So that's a more gentle approach, of course, than doing EDTA or that sort of thing. So let's look at the fecal report. And you can look at all these on your own. So this is the fecal metals doctor's data. It basically shows you the potentially toxics. This person has a really high level of mercury. Now, they may be right in the middle, and lead too. This is probably has been done as part of a process where they're chelating. In which case we'd say, wow, great, good job, you got a lot of metal, got a lot of mercury, got a lot of lead in there, right? We didn't know with the urine whether that was a challenge test or not, so it might have been a challenge test. Beryllium's a little bit high. Platinum, again, maybe it's the same person as the other one. Tungsten. So those are high. So we could be celebrating that the person's high if this was done because of a challenge. But we look down here and it says dental amalgams, yes. It could be that her dental amalgams are leaching and causing excretion. And then it'll go through, again, the different metals, where they're found, and what the clinical significance means. Let's look at the whole blood minerals and then the erythrocytes. Okay, so this is doctor's data again. Toxic and essentials in whole blood. And we're looking at whatever's, you know, in the green range. You'll learn to see patterns as you do them, if you do them. I don't do them enough to have that pattern. This person has very low level of lithium. They're a little bit higher than normal on the magnesium. That's not going to be a problem. It's not a red problem. And okay on calcium. Copper levels are okay. Zinc levels are okay. I would be cautious that this copper's a little bit higher than the zinc, that we don't turn that into a deficiency. And maybe if they are taking supplemental copper, cut back on that. Their lithium is really low. Their manganese, strontium's a little low. You'd want to be asking this person about bone health. Strontium's real important for bones. And then we're looking at the arsenic. So the heavy metals don't tend to be as valid in the serum or the blood. They're usually more of an acute stage. If there's an acute exposure, that'll definitely show. But this shows arsenic, barium. They're all in what's called the safe zone. And then again, they always have these nice little descriptions afterwards about what the report means. And they always give you references. Let's look at an erythrocyte report. You can see they each have their way of doing it. Genova likes to line them up next to each other, and the doctor's data lines them down. The nutrients that they run on this one, the RBCs, chromium, copper, magnesium, manganese, potassium, selenium, vanadium, and zinc. And in this particular case, it looks like we have slight lows on manganese and chromium and copper and selenium. Vanadium's okay, and zinc. So we have some mineral lows. So we might be thinking that this person is having some issues with digestion, with absorption, with stomach acid, or with mercury interfering. Their mercury is really high, right? Their mercury is 0.0315. That would suggest that there's some current exposure to it. When it's high, it's unchallenged, it's right there in the blood. That can't be good to have that much mercury in your blood. Okay, so that's something that needs to be worked on. The lead is high a little bit too, and the antimony. The others are in a safe range. Again, there's a little commentary afterwards about what may be, and you'll get ideas of how to ask your patients for questions. This one was at Doctor's Data. So before the sample, they had 17 micrograms per milligram beforehand. Sample two was the post. They had 43 and then 25 at the 24 hour. So their excretion was 50%. So it says iodine levels include iodine and iodide oxidized to iodine. Excretion percentage is calculated by dividing the milligrams per 24 hours of iodine and by the iodine load. So if they usually give 50, right, in milligrams, 50 milligrams, and then multiply it by 100. So this person had their excretion percentage, where do they show that? There it is. So they excreted 50% of what they took in. Usually iodine is excreted at 90%. So when it's less than that, it usually indicates that there is a deficiency. When we look at bromine, before the iodine challenge, they had 1.7, and after 2.8, a little bit higher. Excretion per 24 hours was 8, so there's a little bit of bromine in the system. The fluoride was much lower, it's just 0.86, and the creatinine they compare this to account for whether they have a right dilution. And there should be an interpretation guide for this. I want to make sure you have an interpretation guide. All of the things I gave you, interpretation dyes, Metametrics, blood, hair, and urine, and they have the same interpretation guide for all three. See how much they give you. See, they give you some nice charts. They give you associated symptoms, and then what's a typical treatment when they're high or low. Thank you guys a lot. Bye-bye now.